I can't start working until my office is clean. I'm too busy to take the stairs. It's faster to wait in this long elevator line. All creative people are messy. I've already showered, so I can't work out. We might need this someday. I'm so far behind, there's no point in doing anything to catch up. I need to get good value from this all-you-can-eat buffet. My instructor will be angry with me because I've missed so many times. I've been working out, so those extra pounds I've gained must be muscle. This will help me concentrate. Unless I can sweat for an hour, it's not worth exercising. One very sneaky, questionable assumption loophole is the belief that a habit has become so ingrained that we can ease off. Keeping track of travel expenses has become second nature to me. I love my morning writing sessions so much, I'd never give them up. Unfortunately, even long-standing habits can be more fragile than they appear, so it pays not to get complacent. People tend to overestimate their dedication. One reader posted, "I gave up Nutella in December 2011. A few years later, I thought I would be able to handle the Nutella once more, so I bought 2 jars on sale. I ate 4,000 calories of Nutella over 36 hours. I experienced this with driving. I'm a fearful driver, and for many years I didn't drive at all in New York City. Finally, I tackled this fear and started driving again. I still very much dislike driving, but I do drive, and I aim to drive at least once a week to stay in the habit of driving so that I don't develop that fear again. More than once, however, I've caught myself thinking, wow, I'm so much less afraid to drive than I used to be. In fact, I don't think I have to drive once a week anymore. Ha! Concern for others loophole. We tell ourselves that we're acting out of consideration for others and making generous, unselfish decisions. Or we decide we must do something in order to fit into a social situation. It will hurt my girlfriend's feelings if I leave her to go for a run. So many people need me, there's no time to focus on my own health. It would be rude to go to a friend's birthday party and not eat a piece of cake. I don't want to seem holier than thou. When I try to change this habit, I get irritable and my family complains. I can't ask my partner to stay with the kids while I go to class. At this business dinner, other people might feel uncomfortable if I don't drink. I'm not buying this junk food for me. I have to keep it around for others. A reader with a great deal of insight into her own loophole seeking posted on my blog, "I blame my lack of motivation on the needs of others. When I get up early, I feel wonderful. It's a very creative and productive time for me. However, both my sweetie and I love using our pre-wake-up time as cuddle time. Although he's very supportive and encouraging of me to get up, my sleepy brain that doesn't want to get out of bed blames my lack of motivation on him. I don't want to let him down, etc. I do the same thing with my mother and eating healthy foods when I am at her home. Although she's supportive, I find myself reaching for the second cookie because I wouldn't want her to feel bad or think that I didn't like them. I know that these are excuses, not reality, but I still end up feeling resentful towards other people." Fake self-actualization loophole. Often a loophole is disguised as an embrace of life or an acceptance of self, so that the failure to pursue a habit seems life-affirming, almost spiritual. You only live once. I'll be sorry if I don't at least try it. I should celebrate this special occasion. How special? National Cheesecake Day? A colleague's birthday? Life is too short not to live a little. I have to take advantage of this now or miss out forever. Fast food joints exploit this loophole. Customers buy more when a limited time offer is tied to a season, an event, or a specific holiday, such as pumpkin spice lattes or heart-shaped donuts. It's too nice a day to spend doing this. I'm afraid of missing out. I want to embrace myself just as I am. I try to remember to accept myself and expect more for myself. When I was explaining my abstainer approach to an acquaintance, she scolded me. "You only live once. Eat a brownie. Enjoy life." "We only live once," I said, "but I'm happier when I skip the brownie." Which is true. For most of us, the real aim isn't to enjoy a few pleasures right now, but to build habits that will make us happy over the long term. Sometimes that means giving up something in the present or demanding more from ourselves. One coin loophole. One of the most insidious of loopholes is the one coin loophole. Insidious because it's absolutely true. This loophole gets its name from the argument of the growing heap, which I learned about in Erasmus's The Praise of Folly. According to a footnote, the argument of the growing heap is, if 10 coins are not enough to make a man rich, what if you add 1 coin? What if you add another? Finally, you will have to say that no one can be rich unless 1 coin can make him so. In other words, even though 1 coin certainly isn't sufficient to make a man only becomes rich by adding 1 coin after another. This teaching story highlights a paradox that's very significant to habits and happiness. Often, when we consider our actions, it's clear that any one instance of an action is almost meaningless. Yet, at the same time, the sum of those actions is very meaningful. Whether we choose to focus on the single coin or the growing heap will shape our behavior. True, any one visit to the gym is inconsequential, but the habit of going to the gym is invaluable. Focusing on the one coin is a way to deny the conflict between our values. A person isn't choosing between the desire to stay close to his extended family and his desire to skip the weekly family brunch to sleep in. Because one missed brunch is no big deal. But when he considers the accumulated cost of the missed visits, the conflict looks different. I haven't worked on that project for such a long time. There's no point in working on it this morning. Or, I'm not going to wear my helmet. What are the chances I have an accident today? Or, I should keep track of business expenses, but there's no point in keeping one receipt. Or, why work on my report today when the deadline is so far off? Or, a year from now, whether I went to a video arcade today won't matter. And finally, what's one beer? By reminding ourselves that the heap grows 1 coin at a time, we can help keep ourselves on track. Also, the mere act of adding 1 coin to the heap strengthens a habit, just as each subtraction weakens it. So each coin is actually 2 coins, the healthy habit itself and the protection and reinforcement of that habit. The habit of the habit is more important than the habit itself. For this reason, it can be helpful to keep a habit symbolically, even if we can't keep it literally, to keep a habit in place. Someone who can't go for a run because his wife is sick can go for a short walk. Someone who can't write for an hour because the kids are home from school can write for 10 minutes. Usually, loopholes are invoked in the heat of the moment, in the eagerness to justify junking a habit. I spend the first hour of my day doing email, but one morning I had several very tricky, annoying emails to answer, and I wanted to walk away from my desk. As I sat there, I could feel my mind generate appropriate loopholes, just like a cell phone searching for a signal. I'm usually so diligent. 1 hour of email won't make a difference. And if I don't answer these now, I'll feel more like answering them later. Spraying into my mind without effort. Then I reminded myself that I'd already decided. I spend this time answering email. By catching ourselves in the act of invoking a loophole, we give ourselves an opportunity to reject it and stick to the habits that we want to foster. Wait 15 minutes. Distraction. Conscious self-denial leaves a man self-absorbed and vividly aware of what he has sacrificed. In consequence, it fails often of its immediate object, and almost always of its ultimate purpose. What is needed is not self-denial, but that kind of direction of interest outward, which will lead spontaneously and naturally to the same acts that a person absorbed in the pursuit of his own virtue could only perform by means of conscious self-denial. Bertrand Russell, The Conquest of Happiness. One evening, I mentioned to Jamie that I was investigating a new habit strategy. When I'm grappling with an idea, talking about it helps me to understand it better. Jamie doesn't always enjoy the role of sounding board, but this night he was game. "What's the strategy?" he asked. "The strategy of distraction." "That sounds easy. I get distracted all the time." "No," I answered, "this isn't the kind of distraction that happens accidentally. You have to do it on purpose, which can be hard." Then Jamie was himself distracted from our conversation by his need to pack for a business trip, so I stopped my explanation. But I couldn't stop thinking about the strategy of distraction. When we distract ourselves, we purposefully redirect our thoughts, and by doing so, we change our experience. Distraction can help us resist temptation, minimize stress, feel refreshed, and tolerate pain, and it can help us stick to our good habits. Of course, it's not enough to be distracted. We must distract ourselves in the right way. Checking Pinterest isn't a good distraction for the person who wants to break the habit of late-night online shopping. Reading a mystery would work better. Also, making a purely mental shift can be difficult, so distraction works best when it involves physical activity. Walking around the block, woodworking, or cleaning out the kitty litter box. Of course, if it's an enjoyable distraction, such as playing catch with a child, so much the better. Using the strategy of distraction doesn't mean trying to suppress an unwelcome thought, but rather deliberately shifting attention. When we try to squash a particular thought, we may trigger the ironic rebound, so that paradoxically, we think about it all the more. The more I try to avoid thinking about how exhausted I'll be if I don't fall asleep, the more insistent this thought becomes, until I'm so agitated that I can't possibly sleep. So I don't try to avoid thinking I need sleep, but instead turn my attention to something else. Although people often assume that cravings intensify over time, research shows that with active distraction, urges, even strong urges, usually subside within about 15 minutes. So now, whenever I'm tempted to break a good habit, or indulge in a bad habit, two sides of the same coin, I say to myself, I can leave my desk in 15 minutes. The delay of 15 minutes is often long enough for me to get absorbed in something else. If I distract myself sufficiently, I may forget about a craving entirely. A friend told me that if she's tempted to splurge while shopping, she resists pulling the impulse purchase from the shelf. I tell myself if I still want it by the time I finish shopping, I can go back for it. But by that time, I've forgotten about it, or it's too much trouble to hunt it down. I only go back if I really want it. Also, telling myself, if I want, I can do that in 15 minutes, often works better, even for an abstainer like me, than telling myself no. No can sometimes lead to the dreaded backlash effect, in which feelings of deprivation make the forbidden more enticing. Waiting 15 minutes proved effective against my growing checking habit. When I was sitting at my desk at home with three monitors, or out in the world with my phone, I felt a more and more frequent urge to check my email, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Pinterest, and all the rest. By the time I checked everything, I could start all over again. I wanted to get this habit under control before it became an official bad habit. This checking habit was inflamed by the phenomenon of intermittent reinforcement. Usually, my email isn't very rewarding, but occasionally, and I never know when, I get an email that's great. This kind of unpredictable, variable, instantaneous reinforcement is the hallmark of many powerfully habit-forming actions, such as playing slot machines. Checking is also rewarding because it offers the possibility of resolution, which people crave. I get replies to my emails, I learn the definition for cholesterol, I see that 150 people commented on my post. And that feels good. Checking certainly yields rewards from time to time, but I didn't want a habit of constant checking, and delay helped me nip this habit in the bud. Now, when I feel myself reaching for my smartphone, or clicking over into email and social media on my desktop, I tell myself, wait 15 minutes. Sometimes I still want to look, but often I'm already in the middle of something else, and the impulse has passed. I've heard all sorts of funny variations of distraction. One person does 20 jumping jacks before eating a snack. Another drinks a glass of water between each glass of wine. Someone else takes a few minutes to be very aware of the bottom of her feet. I've heard that taking a whiff of grapefruit or peppermint helps curb appetite. Many people keep their hands busy as a way to avoid snacking. Giving myself a manicure keeps my hands busy, a friend explained, and I can't eat anything out of a bag if my nails are wet. Distraction can also make it easier to keep my good habits by taking my mind off my worries or giving me relief from the blues. If I can ease myself into a better state of mind, I'm better able to use self-command. No surprise, studies suggest that distraction works best if it directs our minds to something absorbing and pleasant rather than distressing or highly arousing. Shrek, not Schindler's List. I figured that the strategy of distraction could help me soothe the agitation I feel whenever I'm harshly criticized, and soon I got the opportunity to test it. Usually, my reader email is kind, or at least constructive. But in the space of 1 week, one reader attacked my appearance, one reader told me I was a bad role model for my daughters, and one reader characterized my practice of providing bookseller links, with full disclosure of my affiliate relationships, as getting kickbacks. When I get those kinds of emails, my habit, which is challenging to keep, is to adopt a mild tone. Sometimes I even get a cordial response back. One person sent me a harsh email and 3 years later emailed me to apologize. To make myself feel calmer before I responded, I used distraction, poking around on the Science Daily site to help myself muster the self-control to give a civil answer. Along the same lines, I've noticed that some people exploit their smartphones to distract themselves from negative moods. Because he was going to a funeral, a friend would miss an important meeting that we'd scheduled. "Call me tomorrow afternoon and tell me what happened," he said. "I can't call you," I told him. "You'll be coming out of your grandmother's funeral." "I'd like for you to call. It will be a distraction." The strategy of distraction can also help people fight the siren call of potato chip news. I'm not drawn to potato chip news myself, so it took me a while to understand this challenge. Potato chip news is news that's repetitive, requires little effort to absorb, and is consumable in massive quantities. True crime, natural disasters, political punditry, celebrity and sports gossip, or endless photographs of beautiful houses, food, clothes, or people. Its information is usually sensationalized to carry the maximum emotional effect, to make people feel shocked, frightened, envious, outraged, insecure, or indignant. Most of us enjoy potato chip news occasionally, to track the Oscars or the Olympics, for instance. But those who regularly spend hours indulging in it may find they're angry with themselves for watching, and distraught by what they're watching, yet unable to step away. Many people consider spending excessive time on potato chip news as a bad habit in itself, and it can also inflame other bad habits because people get so agitated by it that they lose self-command and turn to bad habits for comfort. One person wrote, "I was so worried about the election that I ate half a pan of peanut butter brownies in front of CNN." It's important to follow the presidential election, but still, we need to deal with remote events in ways that don't derail our attempts to manage ourselves. Distraction can help. By mindfully shifting attention away from potato chip news, people can break free from its time-sucking grip. They can read a novel, play with a dog, do Sudoku, anything to pull away from the screen. Sometimes people limit themselves to written news accounts or establish time limits. One person told me, "I've been shopping on the site StreetEasy for over 3 years. I try to limit myself to visiting the site a couple times a week, but it's hard." Of course, one person's bad distraction habit might be another's good distraction habit. A friend reads the sports and pop culture site Grantland to distract himself when he wants a beer on a work night. On the other hand, someone else said, "I've realized that I can't take a 5-minute break and go to ESPN.com. I read one thing, then another. Plus, I'm from Cincinnati, so I care a lot about the Bengals. And if I read something about how the Bengals suck, it puts me in a really bad mood, and I can't work." Although I'm not attracted by potato chip news, I sometimes find myself falling prey to a related problem, the bad trance. The bad trance often hits when I'm exhausted, as when, paradoxically, I feel both too tired and too wired to go to bed. Often when I'm in the bad trance, I'm overindulging in something I don't even enjoy. I'm watching bad TV, finishing a boring book, eating food that's not delicious, clicking around a website that doesn't interest me, or, most inexplicably, flipping through a magazine I've already read. In a good trance, or flow state, time passes swiftly, yet feels rich, and when I emerge, I feel energized and exhilarated. In a bad trance, time feels neither full nor empty, and I find myself sitting with my mouth half open, regretting the time I've wasted. Every once in a while, I do love to lie in a hotel bed and spend an hour channel surfing, but I don't want to make a habit of going into the bad trance. I watch for the symptoms, a feeling of lethargy that makes it hard to get out of my chair, coupled with a feeling of listless curiosity, and make the effort to distract myself from the lure of the trance. One unexpected benefit of going to sleep earlier has been the marked decline in the frequency of my bad trances. When I'm not exhausted, and when I'm not up too late, I don't fall into this habit. Distraction can be helpful, but it can also be distinctly unhelpful. For instance, the ping of new email kept interrupting my thoughts when I was working, and once I knew I had a new email, it was very hard to resist reading it. Intermittent reinforcement. So I used a few minutes of my next power hour to figure out how to turn the sound off. Also, to avoid unhelpful distractions, I often leave my home office to write in the library near my apartment. I don't work in an office, so I'm not interrupted by coworkers, but at home, even the possibility of interruption distracts me. At the library, I know that the phone won't ring, the doorbell won't buzz, the mail won't arrive. A friend who works in his studio apartment figured out a way to avoid the distractions of napping and snacking. Every morning he makes his bed, eats breakfast, and goes to work for the day, which means he doesn't allow himself to sit on his bed or go into the kitchen, except at mealtime. Author Jean Kerr spent half her writing time in the Parks family car, where she had no distractions from her 4 young sons, and where there was nothing to do except work. Although working at the library solved my distraction problem, at one point I began to wonder if I should train myself to work better at home. Shouldn't I develop the self-control to resist the siren call of email, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and all the rest? Shouldn't I manage myself so I didn't have to pack up and go to the library? Then I realized, no, my existing habits work very well. When I'm at home, I do work related to the online world, such as email and social media. To do the harder work of writing, I go to the library, or less often, a coffee shop. Why force myself to change? I love the library. It's a treat to work there. It's one block from my apartment, so I don't spend a lot of time going to and fro. It's helpful to walk out into the fresh air and sunlight and to have a little break between home and work. Besides, I know myself. I'd need a lot of self-control to develop the habits to limit my internet usage when I'm at home. But at the library, the internet never tempts me. Why waste self-control energy unnecessarily? It's easier to change my surroundings than to change myself. I've discovered another, quirkier focus booster. When I sit down to write, I always have the urge to stick something in my mouth. Gum, a snack, a hot drink, because it helps me concentrate. I can satisfy this urge, I've learned, by chewing on a plastic coffee stirrer. I picked up this idea from Jamie, who loves to chew on things. His favorite chew toy is a plastic pen top, and gnawed pen tops and little bits of plastic litter our apartment. Every time we go to a movie, he grabs a straw to chew while we watch. He also chews on plastic stirrers, and I decided to try it myself. I've been astonished at how helpful this small habit is. I keep stirrers in my office and backpack, and whenever I sit down at my computer, I pop one between my teeth, and it helps me to focus. Chewing on a plastic stirrer is probably the adult equivalent of using a pacifier, but it works. Perhaps it's the placebo effect. But after all, the placebo effect is quite effective. I do worry that it might not be a good idea to chew away on plastic. Oh well. Paradoxically, I find that a brief period of distraction can sometimes help me avoid being distracted. When I'm trying to focus for a long time, it's helpful to take brief, refreshing breaks. Emphasis on the brief. When a friend gets stuck, she juggles. It's the perfect break, she explained. It's fun, it's active, it takes a lot of concentration, yet it's mindless. And I can't do it for very long, so my break can't be very long. I realized I have a habit like that myself, which I'd been treating as a bad habit. But it's not a bad habit, it's a good habit. My habit of wandering through the library stacks to look at whatever titles catch my eye. I love doing this. And I found a surprising number of good books this way. I'd always considered it an inefficient use of time, but actually it was a perfect distraction. The fact is, I can't write for 3 hours straight, or for even 45 minutes. I need a lot of breaks. It's a secret of adulthood. To keep going, I sometimes need to allow myself to stop. No finish line. Reward. The reward of a thing well done is to have done it. Ralph Waldo Emerson, New England Reformers. I'd been practicing meditation for several months without a single day off, and I no longer felt slightly ridiculous as I lowered myself onto my cushion every morning. For the most part, though, I didn't see any change in myself. And that 5 minutes of meditation was becoming more frustrating and boring. One morning, after I'd settled myself into position and set the alarm on my phone, I had a powerful urge to stand right back up. I didn't, but my attempts at an empty mind that morning were foiled by my reflections about why I hadn't jumped up. I sat in the early morning light, not meditating, thinking about my habit. I was sticking with it for two reasons. First, I knew I shouldn't break a good habit on a whim. Decide, then don't decide. Second, because I'd made a habit of meditating, skipping the meditation would make me feel as though I'd started the day on the wrong foot. This is the power of habit. the iron that helps bind me to my good habits and to my bad habits as well. Maybe meditating was changing me imperceptibly. Maybe my struggle to meditate showed just how much I needed meditation. Maybe if I stuck to it, I'd experience a breakthrough. Or maybe not. As an upholder, an argument like, "You've been so diligent, take a day off," didn't really tempt me. But I did briefly think, maybe I should give myself a reward for sticking with meditation. That line of thought seemed dangerous for some reason, but I didn't know why. Wasn't a reward a good way to keep myself motivated? And so on until, with relief, I heard the crickets alarm go off, and I could stand up. This train of thought, plus a brief conversation with a friend, made me focus on the issue of reward and its risks. My friend announced, "I've been dieting, but the minute I hit my goal weight, I'm going to reward myself with a luscious slice of chocolate cake." Even beyond the obvious fact that her plan seemed to undermine the whole purpose of the diet, this struck me as a bad idea. But why? The strategy of reward is a very familiar and popular method to encourage good behavior. It's so familiar and popular, in fact, that it's easy to assume it's effective. Go for a run, have a beer. But do habits work like that? Rewarding good behavior sounds like a sensible idea on the surface, but the more I thought about rewards, about the research I'd read, and more important, what I'd observed in people's behavior, the more skeptical I became. As explored by writers such as Alfie Kohn in Punished by Rewards and Daniel Pink in Drive, rewards have very complex consequences. In fact, I eventually concluded rewards can actually be dangerous for habit formation. If I want to make a habit, I must use rewards in a very careful, limited way. I noted the irony. Studying the strategy of reward meant studying why we should mostly avoid using reward. A reward obstructs habit formation for three reasons. First, a reward teaches me that I wouldn't do a particular activity for its own sake, but only to earn that reward. Therefore, I learn to associate the activity with an imposition, a deprivation, or suffering. This well-documented but too often ignored consequence of rewards relates to the difference between outer and inner motivation. We're extrinsically motivated when we do an activity to get an external reward, a carrot, or to avoid an external punishment, a stick. We're intrinsically motivated when we pursue an activity for its own sake. Drawing on intrinsic motivation makes us far more likely to stick to a behavior and to find it satisfying. Organizational theorists Tom Malone and Mark Lepper identified several sources of intrinsic motivation. Challenge. We find personal meaning in pursuing a goal that's difficult, but not impossible. Curiosity. We're intrigued and find pleasure in learning more. Control. We like the feeling of mastery. Fantasy. We play a game. We use our imagination to make an activity more stimulating. Cooperation. We enjoyed the satisfaction of working with others. Competition. We feel gratified when we can compare ourselves favorably to others. Recognition. We're pleased when others recognize our accomplishments and contributions. The four tendencies can help us figure out which intrinsic motivators might resonate most for us. For an upholder, a habit that's a source of control might have special appeal. For a questioner, curiosity. For an obliger, cooperation. For a rebel, challenge. Despite the greater power of intrinsic motivation, people frequently rely on extrinsic motivation, the easy carrot or stick, to try to prod themselves or others into action. But it turns out that extrinsic motivation undermines intrinsic motivation. So rewards can turn enthusiastic participants into reluctant paid workers and transform fun into drudge work. One study showed that children who got a reward for coloring with magic markers, an activity that children love, didn't spend as much time with markers later as children who didn't expect a reward. The children began to think, why would I color if I don't get a reward? Furthermore, rewarded children produced drawings of significantly lower quality than children who expected no reward. I visited a major corporation that, to encourage employees to attend health lectures, bestows points that can be redeemed for prizes. So why would employees go if they don't get points? As my sister the sage once told me, you want volunteers, not recruits. Many assume that offering a reward will help people to jumpstart a healthy habit, which will then persist after the reward fades away. Not so. Often, as soon as the reward stops, and sometimes before it stops, the behavior stops. When people get paid to exercise, take medication, or quit smoking, they do so. But once the reward has been gained, the behavior may stop too. If an employer gives people $120 for taking a health risk assessment, why would they take it again for free? If I tell Eliza that she can watch an hour of TV if she reads for an hour, I don't build her habit of reading. I teach her that watching TV is more fun than reading. With some behaviors, of course, it's safe to assume that they'll continue, even if the reward stops. I gave Eleanor an M&M every time she successfully used the potty, but I was pretty confident she'd continue to use the potty, even after I cut off her M&M supply. Rewards pose these dangers, and to make matters worse, we often choose a reward that directly undermines the habit, as with my friend's reward of chocolate cake. When I told her that I thought rewarding herself with cake was a bad idea, she protested, "But what will be my reward for losing 10 pounds?" I laughed. Losing 10 pounds! Perverse rewards undermine our efforts and teach us to despise the very behavior we want to embrace. I love the TV show Friends, and one episode captures this tension. Chandler has started smoking again, and Phoebe points out, "But you've been so good for 3 years." Chandler, cigarette in hand, explains, "And this is my reward." The second reason rewards pose a danger for habits is that they require a decision. A habit, by my definition, is something we do without decision-making. Making a decision such as, do I get my reward today? Do I deserve this? Have I done enough to earn the cash bonus? Or does this time count? Exhausts precious mental energy, moves attention away from the habit to the reward, and in the end, interferes with habit formation. With my own habits, I've decided not to decide. I do an action without debate, without evaluation, and without reward. Just as I don't reward myself for brushing my teeth or buckling my seatbelt, I don't consider power hour, exercise, or posting to my blog to be exceptional accomplishments that merit a reward. These actions are habits that run on automatic. The third danger posed by rewards? This one took me much longer to recognize. The risk of the finish line. Setting a finish line does indeed help people reach a specific one-time goal. But although it's widely assumed to help habit formation, the reward of hitting a finish line actually can undermine habits. I constantly work to understand what's happening right in front of me. And when I first noticed that finish lines tend to disrupt habits, I was perplexed. I noticed this phenomenon after several people told me the same thing, practically in the same words that I'd heard from a college friend. He told me, "When I was training for the marathon, I was great about running. I loved it. I took it so seriously that I drove the people around me crazy. I thought of myself as a runner and thought I'd be running forever. Then I finished the marathon. I took the 2 weeks of rest you're supposed to take, and somehow 3 years have gone by. This pattern puzzled me. Shouldn't working toward a specific goal create a habitual practice and supply an emotional satisfaction that would strengthen the habit? Shouldn't the reward of crossing a finish line give people more psychic energy to persevere? I was surprised, almost to the point of disbelief, to observe that finish lines didn't have that effect. Finally, it became perfectly obvious. A finish line marks a stopping point. Once we stop, we must start over, and starting over is harder than continuing. I'd seen this in my study of the strategy of first steps. The more dramatic the goal, the more decisive the end, and the more effort required to start over. By providing a specific goal and a temporary motivation, and requiring a new start once reached, hitting a milestone may interfere with habit formation. It's absolutely true that a reward may help people reach a specific goal, but in the area of habit formation, the aim is to adopt a habit forever, to change the way we live for the better. Not to finish this grant proposal, but to write every day forever. Not to run a marathon, but to exercise forever. In a study of people trying to quit smoking, people offered a prize for turning in weekly progress reports had worse long-term quitting rates than people who had no intervention. And programs that rewarded people for wearing their seatbelts resulted in lower long-term seatbelt wearing than programs without rewards. Aside from the energy required to start over once we've crossed the finish line, the very fact that we've achieved a finish line creates its own problem. Once we decide that we've achieved success, we tend to stop moving forward. As a perfect illustration, a guy told me, "I set a goal for myself, 6 by 30, he said. "I wanted to get a six-pack before my 30th birthday, which was right around the time I was getting married." "Wait," I interrupted. "Let me guess how this turns out. You reached the goal, but haven't maintained it." "Pretty much," he admitted. And he's a behavioral economist. Though it's easy to assume that if we consistently repeat an action, it becomes a habit, often it doesn't work that way. I know someone who joined National Novel Writing Month, where participants write 1,667 words a day to complete a 50,000-word novel in a month. He effortlessly kept pace with the program and thought he was building a writing habit. But once the month ended, he stopped writing. He'd been striving toward a finish line, not building a habit. A blog reader observed, "Hitting the finish line usually means dropping the Lenten habit I've adopted. Pray the rosary every day? I planned to keep it up, but I stopped after Easter." A finish line divides behavior that we want to follow indefinitely, to run, to write, to practice, into start and stop. And all too often, the stop turns out to be permanent. I was amazed to read that within 6 months of delivery, 60 to 70% of women who stop smoking during pregnancy have started to smoke again. They drop the smoking habit for months, and they kick the chemical addiction out of their system. But when they cross the finish line, they start smoking again. The reward of the finish line has a particularly bad effect for people on a diet. Despite its popularity, in 2012, about 1 in 5 American adults was on a diet. Dieting has an abysmal track record. According to a review of studies of the long-term outcomes of calorie-restricting diets, 1/3 to 2/3 of people who dieted eventually regained more weight than they initially lost. Why? Perhaps because people are encouraged to set a goal weight, and once they've hit that finish line, they slide back into their old eating habits. One reader explained, "I followed the Atkins diet to fit into a dress for a wedding, wore the dress, then ate whatever I wanted. The weight came back, but it was really hard to start Atkins again. I didn't have the wedding to keep me motivated." Maintaining a healthy weight requires us not to follow a temporary diet, but to change our eating habits forever. true, some people do seem to have the energy for successive fresh starts, at least if the goals seem valuable enough to them. A friend told me she'd had knee surgery and endured the months of required physical therapy. "The rehab must have been tough," I said. "I know you've never liked going to the gym." "Nope, and now I go regularly." "How were you able to stick to it?" I asked. "I had a goal, to go skiing with my children. I knew that if I didn't do the rehab, I'd never be able to do that." "If you hadn't had that goal, don't you think you might have stuck with it anyway? After all, without rehab, you'd have lost the full function of your knee. That's pretty important." "I don't know," she admitted. "Would I have done it several times a week for all those months? I don't think so. Maybe I would have gone once a week. But for you, the goal of family skiing did the trick." "Yes, and last week we all went skiing together." "Now that you've crossed that finish line, will you keep going to the gym?" She paused. "I think so, because I have a new goal. I want to get in great shape." "It's good you have a new goal, but be careful," I warned. "From my research, I'd say that you're in a danger zone. Your reward marks a stopping point, which means you're starting again, and starting is hard, so pay close attention to the habit." A few months later, I was curious to hear whether she'd been able to use her new goal successfully. When I asked her if she was still going to the gym, she answered, "Yes, because my new goal, to fit comfortably into the clothes I wore on my honeymoon, keeps me motivated." I admire my friend's tenacity, and this approach works for her. I've noticed that some people are serial goal setters rather than habit formers. Also, she's a questioner, so perhaps a succession of finish lines helps to satisfy her desire for justification and sound reason. To me, constantly setting and committing to new goals sounds like too much effort. I find it easier just to commit to a habit. That's the upholder perspective. And many people do indeed find it helpful to sprint toward a finish line. The intense but limited efforts of a blast start can help us jumpstart a new habit or pour new energy into an existing habit. For instance, many people successfully focus on a specific habit for 30 days to help launch themselves into a new behavior. Having done that, they should be careful, however, to recognize the special challenge posed by a finish line so that they can put extra effort into maintaining their good habits after crossing that line. The real test of a 30-day blast start is what happens on day 31. If they want the new behavior to become a habit, they should use if-then planning from the strategy of safeguards to decide in advance how to proceed after hitting the finish line, perhaps by continually setting themselves new goals, just as my friend with a bad knee replaced one goal with another, or by deciding what the everyday habit should be. Because rewards can undermine habit formation, I didn't want to focus on rewards to motivate myself. Nevertheless, a habit must be rewarding in some way, or I wouldn't bother to do it at all. My challenge, therefore, was to make my habits rewarding without sabotaging myself with rewards. How? By finding my reward within the habit itself, with a reward that takes me deeper into the habit. If I look outside a habit for a reward, I undermine the habit. If I look within the habit for the reward, I strengthen the habit. A natural consequence of doing a lot of writing is getting a new, improved laptop. I wear out laptops. The keys start popping off. Once a week, when I do strength training, I walk there and take a taxi home. It's an indulgence to take a taxi instead of taking the subway, but I decided a natural consequence of a demanding workout is feeling tired, and because I'm so tired, I get to take a taxi. I pitched a friend on this approach after he told me, "I want to cut back on my drinking, so I'm giving up drinking for a month. As a reward, I'll buy myself an iPad." Can I suggest thinking about it in a different way if you want to change your habits for the long run? I asked. Sure. If you quit drinking, you'll save money, right? Absolutely. I spend a ton at restaurants and bars. So a natural consequence of not drinking is that you'll have more spare cash. You can choose to spend the money on an iPad or whatever. Getting the iPad isn't a reward for not drinking. It's a natural consequence of giving up drinking and having that money. I don't get what you mean. Say you want to start packing lunch for work. Instead of thinking, as a reward for preparing and bringing in my own lunch, I'll splurge on a lunch at an expensive restaurant on Friday, you think, now that I'm bringing in lunch every day, I'm going to splurge on a fabulous set of knives, so my habit of cooking is more fun. What's the difference? A reward changes your attitude toward a behavior. At some level, it causes you to think, I'm not drinking because I want an iPad. But if you think, I'm not drinking because I want to feel healthier, more energetic, and more in control. Added benefit, I have extra money to buy things I want. That's a different state of mind and might shift the way you view drinking in the future. The reward for a good habit is the habit itself. I visited a Fortune 10 company with a brilliant wellness policy. Any employee who uses the company gym at least 75 times annually gets the next year's membership for free. This offer struck me as a terrific combination of the strategies of monitoring, accountability, convenience, because something feels more convenient when it's free, and reward. The company's reward for exercise is more exercise, which reminds me of the old joke. Making partner in a law firm is like winning a pie-eating contest and being told that the prize is more pie. In addition to the particular benefits conveyed by a habit, the mere fact of sticking to a healthy habit gives me a rewarding sense of growth. Adding one coin to the growing heap is very satisfying. My up band gives me a sense of advancement without the risks presented by a finish line. Continuous progress is the opposite of a finish line. Just because. Treats. One of the secrets of a happy life is continuous small treats. Iris Murdoch, The Sea, The Sea. I'd started many habits over the past several months, and upholder that I am, I embraced them. And I plan to follow them indefinitely. No finish lines. Nevertheless, while I was being more productive and more mindful, sometimes I felt burdened by these new activities. All this effort could be tiresome, even for someone like me. Which is where the delightful strategy of treats comes in. Unlike a reward, which must be earned or justified, a treat is a small pleasure or indulgence that we give to ourselves just because we want it. We don't have to be good to get it. We don't earn it or justify it. Treats may sound like a self-indulgent, frivolous strategy, but it's not. Because forming good habits can be draining, treats can play an important role. When we give ourselves treats, we feel energized, cared for, and contented, which boosts our self-command, and self-command helps us maintain our healthy habits. Studies show that people who got a little treat, in the form of receiving a surprise gift or watching a funny video, gained in self-control. And I know that I find it easier to face power hour if I had coffee with a friend during the day. It's a secret of adulthood. If I give more to myself, I can ask more from myself. Self-regard isn't selfish. By contrast, when we don't get any treats, we feel depleted, resentful, and angry, and justified in self-indulgence. We start to crave comfort, and we'll grab that comfort wherever we can, even if it means breaking good habits. To strengthen my good habits, I decided to create a menu of healthy treats. But that can be more challenging than it sounds. So many popular treats come at a cost. The museum visit requires a long trip across town. The new shoes are expensive. The martini tonight will make the morning tougher. My favorite treat is reading, and reading requires time and concentration, which aren't always easy to muster. A reader of my blog noted, I love to play the piano, but it takes focus, and some days I've already spent out my focus quota. I began by collecting examples of other people's inventive treats. Browsing through art books, cookbooks, or travel guides. Taking photographs on a walk. Napping. Having a session of fur therapy, petting a dog or cat. Wandering through a camping store. Looking at family photo albums. Keeping art postcards in the car visor for a quick diversion in stalled traffic. Going to a comedy club. Going to baseball games, listening to podcasts, coloring in a coloring book, visiting an amusement park, learning a new magic trick. It's important to have some treat options that aren't very demanding. A friend told me, "Every day after I get my kids off to school, I go back to bed for 20 minutes. I may go to sleep, or else I just lie there. I'm still at work by 9 a.m., and that little indulgence makes me so happy." A friend living in London told me his treat. "My calendar is packed, but twice a day, for 15 minutes, I sit and drink an espresso and read the International Herald Tribune. And I don't check email, I don't do work. I don't want any additional breaks, but I'm furious if I don't get those too." Another friend said, "I wonder if there's something a person could do with this sexually, depending on their situation." He laughed. "I don't even want to say out loud what I'm thinking." "No, don't spell it out," I protested. But it's true that treats that come through the body seem to have a special power. Sometimes treats might not look like treats. Writer Jan Struther observed, "Constructive destruction is one of the most delightful employments in the world." I find that true, and tasks like shredding mail, emptying out files, or even peeling hard-boiled eggs can feel like a treat. Funnily enough, clearing clutter is also a treat for me when I'm in a certain mood. On my blog, people wrote about their own untreat-like treats. Ironing, writing code, doing Latin translation. As a treat for herself for her birthday, one of Jamie's colleagues walked to work, 6 miles. Did she do it to prove to herself that she could do it, I asked, or as a treat? "Oh, she wanted to do it," Jamie assured me, "for fun." Although I love hearing about what other people consider treats, I remind myself to be Gretchen. Just because an activity is a treat for someone else doesn't mean it's a treat for me, and vice versa. A friend said, "I love CrossFit. That's a treat for me." Maybe I could reframe my yoga class or exercise generally as my treat, I thought. Then I realized, nope. I do enjoy it in a way, but it's not a treat. A friend told me that her favorite treat was to shop for gifts, a task that for me is arduous enough to qualify for power hour. I wish my bank of fun included activities like sketching, playing tennis, cooking, doing puzzles, or playing a musical instrument, but they're not treats for me. I made a list of my own treats. One of my favorites is a visit to the library. I love keeping a log of books I want to read, looking up the call numbers, and wandering through the stacks to pick them out. Returning library books is an odd little treat, too. Perhaps that's my finisher nature. I love copying out my favorite passages from books and adding them to my various collections of quotations. I view sleep as a big treat, which is why I don't resent the idea of going to bed earlier, the way some people do. For me, it feels like a luxurious indulgence. Beautiful smells are a reliable treat and can be enjoyed in an instant, with no cost, no effort, and no planning. In a flash, I get pleasure from the fresh smell of a grapefruit, or the comforting fragrance of clean towels, or the promising smell of a hardware store. I remind myself to notice such treats, to register the fact that I'm experiencing a scent that I love. After all, we make something a treat by calling it a treat. It's all too easy to overlook how much we enjoy something. When we notice our pleasure and relish it, the experience becomes much more of a treat. Even something as humble as herbal tea or a box of freshly sharpened pencils can qualify as a treat. Look, I tell myself as I light a scented candle, I'm giving myself a treat. Sometimes we can even reframe a challenging habit as a treat, which makes it much easier to keep. A reader observed, when I thought of exercise as something I should do, it was hard to get into a routine. Eventually, I